Running a business is hard enough. Don't make it harder with a dozen apps that don't talk to each other. One for sales, another for inventory, a separate one for accounting. That's software overload. Odoo is the all-in-one platform that replaces them all. CRM, accounting, inventory, e-commerce, HR. Fully integrated, easy to use, and built to grow with your business. Thousands have already made the switch. Why not you? Try Odoo for free at odoo.com. That's odoo.com.
Hey, everybody, it's Mark Pattison. I'm back again with another exciting episode of Finding Your Summit, all about people overcoming adversity and finding their way. And before we get into today's pod, I'm sitting here back in Sun Valley, Idaho. I'm so jacked up. I want to direct anybody that wants to find out more about my expeditions to go to my new website, www.markpattisonnfl. And you can also find more about my podcast. I've got over 155 episodes now with just really amazing people doing incredible things. And also, we continue to form a partnership with Higher Ground and looking to continue to raise more money for my daughter who has epilepsy. And it's called Amelia's Everest, the Lhotse Challenge. So very jacked up about that. And there is a link on that page of my website. Okay, so let's get into it. Today, I'm really, really keyed up because I got an intro through Higher Ground. We'll get into that in just a little bit. But this guy is top gun. He's the real deal. His name is Dick Couch. Dick, how are you doing?
Very well. Happy to be with you.
Yeah, so, boy, we've got a lot to uncover. And I guess the first thing is how does a kid from Mississippi growing up in Indiana end up as a Navy SEAL?
Well, it was a long journey. I can honestly say my mother, who kind of set the adventure in me, she took me to see a movie called The Silent World, Jacques Cousteau. And then I got the book and read it. And I was, we're talking early 50s. Yeah. And so I was 10, 11 years old, and I thought, boy, this looks interesting. And so I got I saved my money, and I bought a regulator, and I got a fire extinguisher bottle and made an aqualung out of it and started diving in the quarries in Indiana. And I decided early on I wanted to be a Navy frogman.
Wow.
And that I never lost that goal.
So I'm thinking back because like even going back 20 years and they're remaking the movie Top Gun and they've had all these SEAL movies out and with Bin Laden being taken out. And of course, that was SEAL Team 6, and then there was all these docs that came out after that on Netflix and other places. And I think the whole program became much more famous or infamous, whatever word you want to use, right? And so I'm interested on what the connection. I mean, I understand that you're going underwater and you're using this your own respirator, but. How did the connection of the awareness of becoming a Navy frogman even enter your brain?
Well, I think I wanted to be a Navy diver. I wanted to do something underwater. So it was a lure of, hey, you know, we find also back then and even today, kids from the Midwest seem to flock to these special operations and the Navy SEALs as opposed to somebody who grew up in San Francisco or grew up in or San Diego or Miami. The sea has a lure, and it certainly did for me growing up in Indiana. I never saw the ocean till I went east to school. But it was sort of a fascination. And so this was the days before there were SEALs. They were just Navy frogmen, and there weren't that many of them. And I decided that's what I wanted to do. Of course, when my time came, they needed SEALs more than frogmen, although I did do both.
So let's get into that then. So in 1967, you become a grad of the U.S. Naval Academy, right? And during that time, let's even go back before that. So now you're in high school, and you've got these dreams about becoming a frogman. And it's also a time of extreme, the social scene. Like, it really actually mirrors a little bit of what's going on today, right? And where from only the standpoint of today, there's people out there, they're marching in the streets, they're protesting, and of course we're talking about Black Lives Matter and the beatings and all that kind of stuff, and obviously there's not a correlation there, but a correlation to we're right in the middle of Vietnam and things are getting crazy around the world and the Cold War and all those things are happening about that time. So I'm trying to equate where there's a lot of unrest in the United States. And did that affect your decision at all in terms of going into one of the academies?
Not so much. I grew up in Indiana. I was an average student, but I was a very good high school runner. So I went to Butler University for 2 years on a track scholarship. And then because I was from southern Indiana, where not too many people were interested in service academies, local congressman was looking for somebody to go. I said I would go, and my running helped. So I was a good college runner. And Vietnam was not on the horizon. It was just it was late 50s, early 60s. There was no social unrest that met my eye. Once I was at Annapolis, then you're into the flow of Annapolis. And obviously we were starting to say, wait a minute, there's a war going on. It seems to be building. And we just assumed that we'd take part in that war. That was not we didn't necessarily look for it, or we didn't want to sidestep it. That was what we were paid to do.
So I remember when I came out of high school, and we were chatting a little bit about this before we went live here, and I told you that I had an opportunity to go to the Air Force Academy, and really the reality of that situation is I just wasn't mature enough to take that on. Going and playing at a major university and fraternity parties and sorority girls and all that stuff seemed to be like a better choice for me. But for you, where did that discipline, because over time, and maybe you had that, you know, in high school and at a younger age, but did you have to be influenced by somebody to really understand what that was going to take for you to rise, to become top of your class and be that disciplined guy to get up and pay attention to detail and all the tactics that you had to learn over time?
I'm not so sure I would say that. Again, I was a middle distance runner, which meant that in academics took all my focus to survive at the Naval Academy and to be a runner there. And my relay team, we were NCAA record holders. You know, I was a good college runner. So sports.
How far were you talking now?
I'm talking half mile.
Yeah. Which is basically a sprint.
Yeah. I was a 152 half miler, and wow. I was a slow man on my relay team. So we had a good indoor relay team. National record holders. Yeah. But I think that I wanted to do this, and I was willing to pay the price. And being a runner and enduring service academy discipline, which was not, you know, I found it to be very much in keeping with what I wanted to do. I didn't find that to be a hard thing at all. And if you're going into SEAL training, being a runner is much better than being a swimmer. I was a good swimmer, and I could get by, but being a runner was far more important.
Yeah, and why is that?
Just because you ran everywhere and there were constantly demands on you, whether you're running in wet clothes and soft sand and what have you. But running, and I found that true in all special operations discipline, the runners do better than almost anybody else. Mm. And I was a runner.
Hmm. Maybe I should have been a SEAL.
Yeah.
Okay. So 1972. No, I want to go back. Sorry. I want to talk about going into the SEALs and into BUT. So where did that come in the timeline in your career?
I graduated in 67. I didn't get to SEAL training BUDS until 1968. Back then, you couldn't leave the academy and go straight into special operations. And even if you could have, my class standing was such that I probably would have had to go aboard ship and then transfer. So I was spent a year and a half aboard ship. I couldn't have had better preparation because being a division officer aboard a destroyer in combat was great training wheels before I went into the SEALs and had to undertake those leadership responsibilities. So because I'd been to college for 2 years, 4 years at the Naval Academy, a year and a half aboard ship, so I was 24, 25 years old. I was pretty well prepared to go into that training. And I found training hard, but I found it to be really in my wheelhouse. In some ways, I'm not a big guy. I'm 150 pounds. I think I was 155 then. It's a little man's game. And I didn't find training too difficult. The challenges came after training in operational service.
So a couple things there. Number one, you said when you're on the ship for a year, you're in combat. Where was that?
Off Vietnam, off North Vietnam. Yeah. I'm kind of proud to say I had more Purple Hearts in my division aboard ship than I did in my SEAL platoon.
Hmm. Wow. And so when you're on ship, so give me an idea what that means. So you're on ship. Are you launching missions from your ship onto land, or are you bombing, or what are you doing?
No, it's gunfire support. We were both in South Vietnam and in North Vietnam doing on-call fire missions, which means we were throwing 5-inch bullets into the beach at certain targets, either call fire from the Marines on shore or Army on shore, or off North Vietnam, engaging targets off North Vietnam. And we got hit once and hurt some people pretty good. So
yeah, you know, I probably 10 episodes ago, I had Rocky Blyer, the famous running back from the Pittsburgh Steelers. And we really got in deep about when he got shot multiple times, and grenade landed on his chest and blew up, and part of his leg, his foot, was amputated, and still going on to having this super successful career, 4 Super Bowls. And just, you know, him reliving that moment of him being waiting for I guess, ground support or ocean support, ship support, you know, kind of blazing the way, and then those guys running in. I mean, it just, I can't even imagine how terrifying that would have been, you know. And so it was just fascinating to go through that with him. So now you go into Bud. So it's interesting because it seems like I've interviewed 3 or 4 SEALs, and they've all been smaller, and I've never put the two together. So, you know, I'm 200 pounds, 6'3". Why is it that you say being a SEAL or going through BUDS is more of a little man's game?
It may be a little different today. The guys are bigger and stronger, smarter, faster, all that type of thing. But in my time, it's you had to run the O course. You if you got hurt and you're a big guy, there's no time to rehab it. You got to run through the pain or else drop out. And it seems little guys, we just didn't get hurt as much. Running the O course, jumping off a 10 or 12 foot wall and taking a roll in the sand and jumping up and keep running. I think it's easier on a smaller body. We don't seem to get hurt as bad. I think a good big man can beat a good little man, but there's a lot more good little men.
Yeah.
So I always felt fortunate to be a smaller guy going through training.
So you go on, you become, you know, top of your class, and you get into a variety of just this leadership. Can you tell me more about the missions that you had to lead? I know you had one very successful mission where you went in and you rescued some POWs.
Right.
Let's talk about that. I mean, that just sounds just like heroic. And and for some, these are my words, of course, but I just think almost like Rambo-ish, where you're in the jungle and, you know, people are being held captive and you guys are coming in and doing your thing. And just it's exhilarating, scary. You know, all the words you can probably throw in there.
Well, I think that there's difference between training and operations. Training equips you with the tools. And one thing about SEAL training then and SEAL training now, it hardens you up. There's almost no physical hardship you can't over. I mean, you can stay awake for days. You can be cold. You can be in the worst conditions possible, and you won't find it. You'll find a way to get through that type of thing. But also, the training is transitory. I'll tell you a quick story here. About 72 of us went into this training. 13 of us graduated. I graduated at the top of my class. I was the honor man. The guy who was down at the bottom and barely graduated and what have you was a guy named officer named Tommy Norris, and he received the Medal of Honor. So you never know what's going to come out of a training class and who's going to. I tell that story because you never know. You may struggle to get through a certain part of what you have to do, and you may be the best of all of them. And Tommy was the best of all of us.
Tell me what exactly it means to get the Medal of Honor. What is that? What's that description?
Well, to receive the Medal of Honor, it has to be in combat. It has to be at extreme risk. There were 3 Medal of Honor recipients and SEALs in Vietnam era. There's currently only about 85 living Medal of Honor recipients today. and that number's going down,
yeah,
fortunately. But it's extraordinary heroism. And
can you tell me what he did to earn that?
He went up into North Vietnam and got two pilots out that were behind enemy lines after the Easter Offensive in 1972. And it was a very difficult and heroic action to go up there and do that. And for that, he received the Medal of Honor. 6 months later, he and another Navy SEAL, Mike Thornton, were on a mission together. And they ran into a battalion of NVA, and they had to fight it out with him. Tom got his right eye shot out. I mean, in his eye and out the side of his head. Mike managed to get him off the beach, get him into the water, and save his life. And Mike got the Medal of Honor, received the Medal of Honor for that. The only time that a Medal of Honor recipient received it for saving the life of another recipient. I'll get a book plug in here. I wrote a book called By Honor Bound that details those two Medal of Honor recipients. But getting back to SEAL training, I think it equipped all of us to know that, you know, if you're hurt, you're tired, you're beat, or you're shot, you can get through it.
So can you talk in detail at all about that rescue with the POWs that were?
Yes, it was not so much heroic. It's as we had good intelligence going in. It was one of my first operations. I can tell you one thing that SEAL training and the preparation before going into combat prepares you for in the SEAL teams at that time, and I think it's quite today, is you go in with the idea that I've got the tools, the people, the mechanics, the weapons, and the wherewithal to conduct operations. So I don't mind saying, you know, going down a dark canal in a sampan with six Vietnamese guys and six Navy SEALs through enemy lines, through checkpoints, we did that as a matter of routine. And I think back on it and I think, gosh, how did we do those things?
Yeah.
But it was sort of in keeping with what was expected, and the guys knew what they were doing. We were well prepared to do things like that, and we felt a little bit bulletproof, which was a false sense of security, but we felt we could do those things. That particular operation, we went through two checkpoints, captured the sentries to get into the base camp area, and then we were in the middle of them shooting, and they didn't know what was happening. So it was very lucky, and it was due to the professionalism of a couple of my petty officers, my experienced SEALs, who knew what they were doing and kind of helped the new officer get through that and get to the right place at the right time. But it was very gratifying taking guys out of cages and bringing them back.
So when you go through all that, is you know, it's in mountain climbing, and of course I've had to postpone Mount Everest on to next year, but on all these other mountains that I've scaled, you know, a lot of people always talk about, hey, did you make the top? And really, it's the question is, did you make it to the top and back down safely?
Yeah.
Right? Because
yeah,
you're only halfway there.
Yeah.
And in your case, what we're talking about is you have to go through all these obstacles. People are shooting at you. You're trying to sneak in, create the element of surprise. Now you're in. It's a firefight, and now you're going to achieve your objective. And then coming back out the other side, now you got to get these guys out of there, as well as yourself, safely. And is that equally as hard as going in?
Depends on the operation. On that particular operation, I managed to get the POWs out on a helicopter, and then we came out on boats, but I had helicopters shooting in front of us, putting in fire and providing close air support and trying to scare off any bad guys. You're always worried about how do you get in and how do you get out, and if possible, you try to go out a different way than you came in. Sometimes it's not always possible, and that's when the pucker factor goes up. If you come down a canal and you go to an objective and you have to go back up that canal, it's in the back of your mind that there somebody could be waiting for you, and that's real. The cardinal rule is don't go back the way you came in, and don't go back twice. At least
good
back
info.
Then.
Yeah. So you're in SEAL Team 1. Help educate everybody out there who's not part of SEALs, which is not many, what the difference is between SEAL 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. I know there's a lot of notoriety around 6 because of Bin Laden. But what makes the difference between a 1 and a 2 or a 3?
it's over the time it's been different. Back in my day, there was SEAL Team 1 in West Coast, SEAL Team 2 on the East Coast. There was never more than about 350 of us, and probably never more than maybe 100, 120 of us in country at any one time. So very small organization. Today, there's probably 2,400 active SEALs. You've got 1, 3, 5, and 7 on the West Coast, and 2, 4, 8, and 10 on the East Coast. And of course, the SEAL Team X there that you talk about, that I'm not supposed to talk about, but it's obviously there. Mm-hmm. They're configured very much the same, or at least the line SEAL teams are, you know, with the exception, I call it the Special Missions Unit. You know, they're special, and they are indeed special. They have very good capabilities, but their focus of their training and operational is on direct combat assault, whereas the rest of the SEAL teams are pretty much generalists. They can do direct action, civil affairs. They can do foreign internal defense where they work with other people. That's what they're doing a lot of right now, training others. And some of them have they used to at some point in time, I don't know whether they still do, have regional association. In other words, you get one team that's kind of has a Latin American look to them, a lot of Spanish speakers, mm-hmm. a lot of Tex-Mex guys. Others may have another area of specialization. But as they're configured and deployed, they're pretty much interchangeable, and they can do a lot of things, including a lot of maritime operations that they don't get much. You know, all you hear about is Afghanistan, Iraq, Yemen, Somalia, places like that. But they do a lot of over-the-beach work, too, and they work with a lot of other foreign special operations components to help them bring their training up. So combat assault, direct action, those are just one of the capabilities. Most SEAL teams have a very broad portfolio.
How many operations were you in?
I can't remember.
Yeah. And when they break it down to, there's a lot, sure. When you have a grand total of X amount of SEALs that are out there, and then they're divided by East and West Coast. Typically, what is a team? How many people are in that unit?
Well, in my day, we deployed as individual platoons. The team basically was a training entity that trained up platoons and sent them forward. Here's the platoons, all qualified, ready to go, and they go into an area. Ours, well, Vietnam, that's all you did was go and come to Vietnam. You went into an operational area. There was an operational commander. Mine was a Marine colonel, and you know, he called the shots, but he let us do what we wanted to do within reason. And so we kind of ran our own operations, but we were by ourselves as a platoon. Today, each SEAL team has 6 operational platoons, and they deploy as a team. And, you know, the commanding officer, the XO, they have an intelligence unit. They plus up into a squadron size. They may have boats. They may have air assets. They've got security. They've got a lot of things. They go forward with their own command and control structure. They set up in an area, a headquarters, and they may have platoons or task units, which is a 2-platoon element, off at a different location. And they work up their targets. Their requirements are laid on them. They work up their targets, their intelligence. It could be that they're in totally a training mode where they're there to train the locals how to conduct special operations. And they may go out with them. They may be with them. But their job is to help those guys do their job. Candidly, I think a lot of guys would rather go out and do it themselves. They love the direct action, but it's very important. You can't go home until you train the guys you're going to leave in place behind you. So they deploy and a team pluses up and expands to a SEAL squadron, goes overseas, sets up in an area, and reports into an area commander. It could be a special operations commander. It could be a Marine area commander. Could be an Army commander. And they take their tasking. They put their people to work, and typically they're gone for 6 months to crack. In a perfect world, and I think we're getting back to that, they're overseas 6 months, back 18 months.
Mm-hmm. This is kind of an odd question, but because of your training, right, which was intense, and all the combat experience that you've had, do you walk into a Starbucks, I'm making this up, and you are looking at your surroundings differently and people walking in than, say, me, right? I just go in there and get my tea and a bagel or something, and off I go. I don't even think twice about who's in there. Do you see the world slightly differently because of that training?
I don't think so. That's me, and I don't think that's the case at all. And I've been out of it for a while, and I've done a lot of different things. But I don't think that I look at it any differently. I've spent more time with special operations components training and in my book work and things like that.
So you don't.
I have higher than average situational awareness, but it's not. I don't walk in and take the table in the corner with my back to the wall, so I can see what goes on.
I just want to know next time I walk into Starbucks and I see you there.
Well, if I do take that table there, it's so I can watch the ladies come in to get their coffee.
Well,
I
mean, that's a good answer. That's a great answer. Okay, so what makes a great leader? You know, you've written books, and we're going to get into 11 books. You're an amazing, prolific author. I want to talk about those, a lot about your experience. But, you know, when you cook all this stuff together, right, and you put it in a jar, and you're looking for that probably alpha dog that's going to be able to lead effectively and provide a strategic and tactical goals, like, what is your definition of that?
I think from all I've seen, and again, I look at the leadership issues. I look back at my time when I was in the barrel in leadership, and if I could go back and change anything, I'd go back and try to do a better job. But I think that leader has to have a tactical command of what he's doing and what his responsibilities are, and be able to look at those he's leading and seeing who he can trust and in what roles he can trust them and who he maybe can't. There's some guys that are pretty good, but they need to be out there on the perimeter doing security, and somebody else might say, I need you to take those three guys and go over there and do that. I think understanding the mission, what your people are capable of, and putting them in the roles where you can supervise your subordinate leaders. I'll tell you my story on that is maybe by example is, I don't know this to be a fact, but I can imagine that the guy in charge of the raid to get bin Laden, he wasn't kicking any door. He probably never fired his weapon. He's got a radio in each hand. He's talking to his element leaders and squad leaders. He's standing out in that courtyard. He's got the White House coming in his right ear. He's got his squad leader reports coming in his left ear. He's sorting things out, making decisions, sending people where they are. That's a leader. And you've got to listen to and trust your subordinate leaders. And I don't know who that guy is, but I'm sure that he stood out in that courtyard, he was like an orchestra leader, you know, leading things and bringing on the brass section and the timpani section and the percussion section, and orchestrating that raid and watching it unfold. Sometimes that leader's not out front; he's back there directing his people. And he's got the key people doing the right jobs in the right places. So that's it. Knowing your people, listening to your people, gaining their confidence, and trusting the getting the right people to the right point in the operation.
You know, when you're talking about that, you're just giving me goosebumps because it really is taking me back to my football days, right? And it's the quarterback, and then you have your receivers, and you have your linemen, and you have your DBs and all that stuff. But at the end of the day, it has to be coordinated by the head coach. And I had some amazing head coaches, Don James and Jim Mora and Tom Flores and other guys. And, you know, their ability to sit back and really understand how the pieces of the puzzle all came together. I want to transition out because you now leave the SEAL team and you enter into the CIA, right?
Right.
So we've been watching. I'm sitting here with Darce, and we've been watching this Jack Ryan. You know.
Oh yeah.
Right. And I can't. I'm so bummed out because I did a binge watch. I did season one, season two, and I'm like, how in the hell can we get a season three? I need it now. Right.
It's good fun.
It's great fun. And so when I think, you know, when I saw this in your bio, CIA, you know, I don't know if your code name is, you know, Lizard or something.
Oh,
but,
no.
Right. I don't, tell me more about your role in the CIA and what that meant.
Well, I was, the CIA did a lot of. did a lot of things and does a lot of things. And most of it centers around foreign intelligence and the gathering of foreign intelligence. And in, within the DDO, the Deputy Director for Operations, a lot of the focus is on human intelligence. You know, there's a whole vast array of CIA and other agencies that do technical collection. But as far as the human collection, that's the main goal of the operational side of the house. I was a paramilitary type. In other words, I was, you know, the guys who were over in Laos or the guys that are the Special Activities Division today that are over in Afghanistan, Iraq, places like that. That was the business I was in. So it was more of a paramilitary business. I tell you, a quick anecdote, I was looking for work after getting out of the Navy. And, of course, the CIA was very interested. And I went through the process and hiring and polygraphs and under a commercial cover and all this fun kind of stuff. But I checked into CIA. And so I went down to my division and was in the Special Operations Division. They said, oh, yeah, we heard you were coming. Do you know how to type? And I said, excuse me? And he says, you know how to type? And I says, no. I mean, in my era, people didn't type. There was no computers, you know. And he's the guy pulls out his drawer, hands me a Gregg typing manual, and he says, go learn how to type. I said, go where? And he said, I don't care. I says, well, how long? And he says, I don't care, but don't come back unless you can type because you'll never keep up with the paperwork here. So I went away and learned how to type. It was the best skill I've ever learned. It drove my professional career.
Yeah. Well, look at you now because you're an author.
Yeah, that's it.
Right?
Yeah. That's but it all started at CIA.
Yeah. So I, you know, it's interesting that you said that because I was trying to understand the connection between being a Navy SEAL and being combat and all this and then going into the CIA. And, of course, I think it more as an intelligence officer working for Washington, D.C., you know, and all that stuff. And so you weren't doing that. You were actually really boots on the ground. Where was your favorite place, whether it was a conflict or not, where was your favorite place around the world and as it relates to this type of work that you were doing to be in?
I didn't say, you know, I tried to sidestep and I managed to sidestep not going back to Laos or back to Southeast Asia. I worked for the maritime branch, did some technical collection, did some beaconry, did some counter drug stuff. And so I was in and out of there. I didn't travel or I didn't go back to deploy per se. The intelligence, that was a time of change. This was Vietnam was winding down. Southeast Asia was winding down. And they were still recovering from the Cuban ops there. So the CIA was under, there was kind of a shrinking organization, including the paramilitary-wise. Don't forget that in Vietnam, the whole United States military fought three NVA divisions in Vietnam. In Laos, about 60 case officers and the Montagnards and the locals fought two NVA divisions to a standstill until they finally got kicked off the Plaine des Jars. So it was almost a contracted war. Yeah. And they still had that capability to go places and you know, run operations like that, even though that most of the money goes to technical collection and the foreign intelligence side of the house.
How would that be for you? You know, when it, let me go back again to Rocky Blyer. And when I was talking with Rocky, you know, there was a big emotional moment when he returned. He was part of this ESPN feature, and he went back to the battlefield, and he literally broke down and, you know, had a hard time with that. Have you been back to Laos or Vietnam since?
I have. I've traveled over there, and I don't know what it is with me. Well, I think it's my background. I come from a good bit of alcohol in my family growing up, and so I have compartmentalization skills that are off the chart. But I saw no, you know, I enjoyed going there. I didn't particularly want to go down in the mangrove swamps and what have you, but some of the beaches, some of the places, the people, I didn't feel, you know, it's very disconnected from the war. I don't think about that. That's a chapter that was very easy for me to close.
Yeah, I think a lot of it for him, too, was where, and I don't believe this happened to you, it was where he got wounded. You know, he was in this crazy firefight, and, you know, he got shot a couple times and blown up this grenade. you know, and all this madness happened, all this rush of time, and so it was the first time back on that soil, and he was asking the question, for what,
right,
at the end of the day. And it's a good question to ask, but he had that emotional experience on that particular piece of dirt that mm-hmm. he was standing on, and it doesn't sound like you did.
No, I didn't, and it depends. Some people, they get real – it occupies a very big piece of their life and their formation there. And everybody processes it differently. And I, for a while, I thought that, gosh, something must be wrong with me, because I, you know, to me, that's the, you know, junior high, you know, the growing up in high school and getting rejected by, you know, when I ask a girl for a date, you know, all those were traumatic things, but they almost are the same as combat experiences. For some reason, it just didn't stick to me. And I think it had to do with how I grew up and my ability to just say, well, I'm just not going to think about that. And I totally respect people who are very emotional, and it's made a big impact on their lives. I totally understand that and respect it.
Yeah. Let's shift into these books. I'm trying to get one book out the door, and you've got 11.
Actually, I've got 22 published works.
Are you kidding me?
No, I'm not.
Wow. So where did you transition out, you know, the CIA, and you're doing other stuff? Like, tell me how the ideation of that, like, I want to, like, recount. And then, and then not only that, but then 22 different themes, right? I'm just trying to figure out one theme, and I can't even think about 22 or two, right?
Well, I found it an easy thing to do. First of all, they all follow special operations training. I'm very fortunate to have about half my work is novels and half my work's nonfiction. I got to thinking, you know, I've been a Navy SEAL, I've been in combat, I've been in CIA. I think, you know, I'd like to write a book. I think I could do that. And so I started writing a spy book. And I was in the store one time, and this was like 89. I saw a book on Navy SEALs, and I picked it up, and I looked at it, and I go, wow, I better take this home and read it. And it wasn't about Navy SEALs. It was about a guy who was a 50 caliber gunner on a PBR, which saw a ton of combat, by the way. You know, I mean, these guys really, really were under fire. But he wasn't a Navy SEAL. So I fought my way through the publishing house, talked to the editor, and I said, I kind of enjoyed the book, but he's not a Navy SEAL. And he said, well, we put Navy SEAL on there because that's a hot topic. I got, oh, that's a hot topic.
Yeah.
So I decided I'd write a book about SEALs, and there was Rogue Warrior out there, but it was not really about SEALs. That's something totally different. And I thought two things. I wanted it to be kind of like Stephen Crane, Red Badge of Courage. I mean, what's it like to want to go think about combat and, hey, I'm going to go to war, and what's the reality? There's a disconnect between what you think it's going to be and what it's going to be. And I got Red Badge of Courage, Stephen Crane, read it again. Another book, Flight of the Intruder by Stephen Kuntz. He put you in the cockpit of that A-6. And he literally did have his bomber navigator, the guy next to him, shot and killed in the cockpit while he was on a combat mission. But I felt he could put the reader in the combat. And I thought, you know, if I can capture what Stephen Crane did of combat, what's it like to the reality of doing it, and put the reader in the squad file, then I'm going to have a book. So I took all the war stories I'd heard, that this, that, and the other, and I stitched them all together in a young man who comes out of college, and he's an All-American soccer player, and he gets into this business. And we've been in sports and tried to take our sports to the next game. That's what this guy did. But he wanted to be somebody special. But he never banked on, and how his emotional journey through going into combat and how it affected him was kind of the heart of the first book I wrote, SEAL Team One.
It sounds a little bit like you.
Yeah, and
right?
The publisher says, "Can you make this first person? I mean, is this real? Can you make it yourself?" And I said, "Look, all these things happened at one degree or to somebody else," and I'd heard stories, but I said, "No, you know, this is a novel." And it did very well. And is almost like I got a jump start on it. My second book got well reviewed. And so I was kind of off and running, but I hit the right. There was no books on seals. I mean, there's nothing out there. And I had and then about the time my novel career, my first four books were starting to fade out. You know, I'm writing these novels, and publisher came to me and says, "Can you?" Thomas Ricks wrote a book called "Making the Core" about the transition of a young guy goes into boot camp, what have you, and he documented that. And he says, "Can you do that for Navy SEALs?" And I thought, "Gee, I don't know. I've never written a nonfiction book." So I wrote a book, The Warrior Elite, about the training of SEALs. Back then, I call up a buddy who was running the training unit and said, "Hey, I think I'd like to book there, write a book on this. Could I come down?" He said, "Yeah, come on down. No problem." There was no vetting, no do this, do that. Nobody reviewed the manuscript. They just said, "Yeah, we trust you. Go ahead and do this." So I wrote The Warrior Elite, The Training of Navy SEALs, and it came out in November at 9/11. It came out right almost the same day of 9/11. I mean, wow. Talk about, you know, so I got, my career got a jump start on that. And then I went to the other special operations venues. So I've been very lucky. I've kind of threaded needles, and it seemed like what I was writing, what I thought I could write, became very popular as I was writing it.
Well, I say this frequently on this pod, which is preparation meets opportunity, and you have the experience and you happen to be in the right place at the right time.
That's it.
And then the magic happened, right?
Yeah.
So I want to make sure that, because there's, you know, 22 books out there, that people know where to go find those books, and where is that?
You know, I always plug your local bookstore. They may or may not have one back there on their dusty shelves. Yeah. Amazon has them all, and most of them are on tape. You know, or you can get paperbacks or buy them used. They're Amazon.com carries them all.
Yeah, and I think people can route through that through your website, dickcouch.com, and there are links there. Today, we are sitting in the offices of Higher Ground.
Right.
And so I just want to talk to you really briefly about what's your connection with Higher Ground, because we, of course, got introduced by our mutual friend Aaron, who put us together as we sit here today.
Well, when they first started Higher Ground, a long time, it wasn't called Higher Ground. It was Sun Valley Adaptive Sports, and it was two people, and they were doing things. And they thought, well, why don't we extend the adaptive sports for people who have maybe a physical impairment to people in the military? And so there was a couple of veterans that they called on, and so we sort of talked about it and consulted with it and helped with it. And so I've been kind of involved as this organization has grown into, you know, they do a lot of different things, but the veteran support aspect of that is a large part of what Sun Valley Adaptive Sports does. Also, it was right after 9/11 that everybody, you know, it seems like there's just a wealth of money being directed toward veterans' benefits and helping veterans out. And this is Sun Valley. This is a wealthy community. So it grew. And so I've kind of been called on to help along the way.
That's awesome. Yeah. That is awesome. You know, look, I'm so respectful of you and your service to America. I consider you a war hero. And anybody that helped allow me to do some of the things I've done in my life and the freedoms that we share here around the United States, you know, my hat's off to you and full salute. So thank you so much for that.
Yeah. Well, and I will say that a lot of people come up to me and say, thank you for your service. And I almost want to not bite my tongue, but say, thank you for allowing me to serve. It was everything to me. It was a privilege, not a burden.
Well, you are clearly one of those guys who see the world in the right spot, right? I mean, and that's just what it gets down to. Okay. Well, listen, I appreciate you so much coming on the pod.
My pleasure.
Yeah, sharing your story. You're incredible. You've done just fascinating things. And I think the world's a better place with you in it.
That's great. Well, thank you for saying so.
All right. There he is, Navy SEAL Dick Couch. Thank you.
Hey, and thank you so much for listening to the Find Your Summit podcast. We are so glad to have you along for this journey. And if you enjoy the show, please tell a friend, share it on iTunes, spread it to the planet. We're looking to broadcast this to every person that is out there because, as you know, everybody has their own summit that they're going after. Okay, if you're looking to follow my journey, you can find that through my social links on markpattisonnfl.com. That's Mark, M-A-R-K, Pattison, P-A-T-T-I-S-O-N, nfl.com. So, until the next podcast, just remember, clear eyes, full hearts, and remember, it takes a little more to make a champion, so make it happen. Thank you. Bye.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.
Attention parents and grandparents. If you're looking for a gift that's more than just a toy, give them something that inspires confidence and adventure all year long. Give them a Guardian bike, the easiest, safest, and number one kids bike on the market. With USA-made, kid-specific frames and patented safety technology, kids are learning to ride in just one day. No training wheels needed. It's why Guardian is America's favorite kids bike and the New York Times and Wirecutter's top pick 3 years in a row. This holiday season, Guardian is offering their biggest deal of the year. Up to 40% in savings on all bikes, plus $100 in free accessories. Guardian bikes have become the most sought-after gifts of the season. And inventory is going fast, so don't wait. Join over 500,000 happy families who've discovered the magic of Guardian. Shop now at guardianbikes.com. That's guardianbikes.com.